win. Okay, Carmen did a great job of sort of setting me up, because what I thought I would do is start with the statement that I made at EFICOM that evidently people were surprised at, I guess, which was, I actually did it as a prediction. I predicted that computer ethics would disappear, will disappear. I think I still stand by this, but I think the more important thing is, you know, why I would be led to that conclusion. And actually, Herman did a pretty good job of sort of summarizing it. The basic idea is, I began thinking about sort of why, why. First of all, they're from the very beginning, from the first moment of computer ethics, there were people who sort of raised this question and argued that none of the issues were unique. I've actually sort of begun to try to think about why that question even arose. I mean, why wasn't it just ethics? But for some reason there's some resistance. But in any case, the question, that question has sort of continued to puzzle me, and as I've worked on that question, I've begun to sort of think about the fact that you know, the technology is new, and so all the issues around the technology get attention, but as the technology becomes standard, then as their uniqueness sort of pushes into the back. So, but I don't want to get there too quickly. Let me make three or four points, and then I'll come back to that. The first thing I want to, one other thing. When I make that statement, I'm really talking about the framing of the issues. The issues are not going to go away. You know, I mean, that would be foolish for anybody to claim. That is, there are always going to be ethical issues, whether their relationship to the technology is the focus or not. The real issue is, are they going to be framed as issues of information technology, or issues of computer ethics? Or what I suggested was, in the end, that what we call computer ethics will become ordinary ethics, and that for us, the better way to think is ordinary ethics will become computer ethics. Okay, so the first thing I want to do is suggest to you that this is really a kind of puzzle for me that I've been trying to sort out. And so the first thing I want to point out to you is, one of the things that seems clear about the puzzle is that people who make the strong claim for the issues being unique seem to be primarily or firstly focused on the technology. That is, they when you start with the technology and you begin to ask this question about uniqueness, it seems very clear that nothing like information technology existed before. Now, I know immediately all the counters come to mind. That it's it's an extension of calculating machines and blah, blah, blah. But nothing, certainly with the power and the capacity of computer technology, existed before. And in that respect, and certainly the things that we can now do, emphasis on we, human beings, can do with this technology, we couldn't do before. We can have a long argument about, whether it's scale, whatever, but I would never want to deny the uniqueness of the technology. On the other hand, the people like me who are sort of more focused, as the starting place is always on ethics, I start out with sort of some idea about ethics, and then a whole set of categories in my mind about what ethical issues are that they have to do with human-to-human interaction and harm to one another and taking responsibility and privacy and property rights and the whole list. So for me, I'm struck by the fact that whatever the issues around the technology, they always come back to people and humanity. And so for me, the fact that the technology is involved means that there's a new twist and there's something different going on, but it doesn't, I still am sort of convinced that as ethical issues, we have twists, we don't have anything new. And I can say more about that, but I want to get to move in a different direction. Second point I want to make is that, from somebody who's sort of started out in ethics. The interesting insight for me, which now seems sort of almost simple-minded, it goes like this. In the past, through the history of ethics, it's a very complicated story to tell, but it essentially goes like this. People who have recognized ethical issues and written about ethical issues, either professional philosophers or people out there in the world who have experienced ethical issues and called them ethical issues, have in fact always presumed a certain kind of world in which those issues have arisen. And even though I think we now understand thinking about computing and lots of other technologies, we understand, and actually this is where Jim Moore helps so much, Jim Moore talks about the fact that computers create new possibilities, and there are new possibilities for human behavior, there are new possibilities for human institutions. What happens there is that technology, and computing in particular, but technology in general, instruments human behavior. So it's not like we now have, and I'm saying this in the wrong group, it's not like we now have this new set of beings, computers. What we have is human beings doing things, and they're doing things through machines. And ethical issues have to do with the way we treat one another, and now there's this thing in between, this machine or whatever, and that machine doesn't, the machine actually does make a difference in a relationship because it means that we can do things to one another that we couldn't do before. It means that we can arrange ourselves in all kinds of social institutions and have practices that we couldn't have had without that technology. Now, but to go back to my strain of thought, ethical theorists have never focused on that instrumentation and the difference that that instrumentation makes. What they've always done is just assumed human beings in the natural world. And the interesting thing, of course, is that in doing that, in focusing on human beings in the natural world, they, of course, are always presuming a certain kind of embodiment. They're presuming that we can't fly except, with airplanes. They're assuming that we have certain bodies. And in some sense, the machine between us is an extension of our bodies, because now we, when we do this, we can now do incredible things if our fingers are touching the keyboard. But philosophers never focused on the instrumentation of human action. And so I think I want to, on the one hand, sort of say this is really important for ethicists to recognize. It's, by the way, in some sense, not new. It just went by invisibly. After all, there are guns. Guns changed what human beings can do to each other. Automobiles changed the kinds of relationships and institutions we have, and so on. So it's not new. It's old. The focus on computing has somehow brought the importance of, or the, brought into our sight, instrumentation, the instrumentation of human action. And so you can see, if you're kind of following me, how this both makes me, is consistent with my idea that there's, it's old and new. This is not, what's not new is ethics, the ethical issues, ethical categories. But what is new is the kinds of ways we can interact with one another. So ethics isn't new, but what human beings can do is new. So with that, sort of backdrop, you can see that in the end, what I think is that somewhere down the road, as we have fully digested, and maybe we never will fully digest information technology, we will just simply presume, when we do ethics, a background in which that technology is there, and human beings can do the things they can through that technology. And so ordinary ethics will be, in effect, computer ethics. And computer ethics, framed as such, will disappear because it will just be the way human beings live. I'll stop there.
Okay, our next speaker will be Jim Moore from Dartmouth. And meanwhile, I'll try to adjust this screen.
Well, I wasn't at the meeting in Rome where Deborah gave her a paper, and I only learned later that she had predicted the end of computer ethics. and I was shocked. Nobody told me that it was going to disappear. And so I do have reactions about it. I think I hold a thesis which is not far from Endeavor's, but is different from hers. And so it would be good to contrast the two views. What I think Deborah said about the uniqueness question is right. When you talk about uniqueness, people sometimes talk about the uniqueness of the moral question, sometimes the uniqueness about the technology. Those are really different questions. And I've always done it in terms of the technology. So I think that's the key point. And the reason that was raised before is when we talked about computer ethics many years ago, people always said, well, why isn't there toaster ethics or something like that? And computer ethics, what's the difference? And then you try to say, well, look, this is a special machine. It's not just a toaster. Toasters are good for toasting, but computers are really good because they're, I would say, logically malleable. You can think of an algorithm to do the job. You can get a computer to do it. So they have this special property, and that's why you have a unique one. Now this begins to, however, impinge upon the ethical issues, because for me, the fact that the machine is logically malleable means you are constantly going to be able to generate new possibilities you hadn't thought of in the past. And then you will say, well, gee, if I can do this and I can do that, and suddenly you get a lot of new situations that you don't really have well-defined answers for. And you get what I call policy vacuums. You try to figure out what's what, and sometimes it's very complex. You're not even sure how to characterize the problem. So you can have something like the Napster situation, and you say to yourself, well, is that really a violation of copyright or not? What if it were done in the copy wasn't really put on the person's computer, kind of fed into bits across the screen, would that count as copyright? So you have certain conceptual issues going on about what counts for what. And then you also have the question then framing some kind of policy that makes it work. Now, my take on the future is this, that things are going to get better and better, or worse and worse, depending upon how you see it. I mean, it's going to get better and better for people doing computer ethics because there's going to be an increasing number of problems. When I talked about computer ethics in my 85 article, I thought about the computer revolution. I kind of divided it in half as what I call the introduction stage, where kind of introduce the equipment and they're almost like toys, and that lasts for about 50 years, I would imagine. And so roughly World War II up to 1990. But there was a permeation stage in which a lot of people had access to it, right? And then just everybody could say, well, gee, could I use this to do my job? And then it would kind of take off. And it seems to me that that's, you know, roughly right. But what I now appreciate more is that there are a lot of sub-revolutions going on. And so if we see that with the wide world, with the web, right, where you have a new technology, a sub-revolution starts. Initially, it's just kind of introduced. You have Mosaic, it doesn't work all that well. And you get Netscape and other browsers. And suddenly, a lot of people have access, and now everyone's using it. If you're in business, you're not using the web, why not, right? So you have this kind of sub-revolution going on within the whole revolution. So what I see now, if I look ahead, I'm trying to look ahead, say, 10 years, is that you look out to sea, I see lots of sub-revolutions within the computer revolution coming in. So if you look at things like the increase in computing power, you have Moore's Law, nothing to do with me. The computing power roughly doubles every 18 months or 2 years, depending upon which version of the law you have. And you have Giller's Law, where the bandwidth is increasing even faster. You have the possibility of a lot of connectivity of the web, not only to your computer screen, but to your house, right? Anywhere in your house, you can imagine it would be nice to have it connected to the web so you can control it. If you're, say, driving home and you want to turn the heat on or start dinner or whatever, that will become a possibility. And that seems like it's just over the horizon. You can see these waves coming in the next couple of years. It's going to get a broad number of people will hit the permeation stage for that sub-revolution, and suddenly there will be lots of new activities because there will be lots of new situations for which we don't have policies. And if you look at it a little bit further, that's kind of the near future, You see other things happening you know are going to happen. You don't know exactly how they're going to happen. You see computing taking place in genetics and nanotechnology and robotics and so on. You know some revolutionary things are coming here. So what this means for me is, since I see it kind of come from the bottom up, I think Deborah sees it coming from the top down. For me, what drives computer ethics are all these new problems I'm sure are going to arise as these sub-revolutions mature. And we will have our hands full. So it's not a question of can we avoid it. Philosophers and sociologists and lawyers and so on are all going to have their hands full trying to figure out what sort of policies to enforce in given situations. So I think we've seen a lot already in the computer revolution. We haven't seen anything yet. I mean, it's really going to, 15 years from now, will be much different even than it would say from now back to the 85. So it's there's going to be a lot of new problems. And I think because of the nature of the computer, again, because of the logical malleability, this is probably going to continue for a long time. So if you're thinking about a career move, this is a good career move. You're going to have a lot of stuff to do, and it's not going to disappear any time soon. Now, to be fair, I think Deborah and I agree that a lot of this has to do with the problems, and she's in agreement, I think, I hope, that these problems are going to come in the future. The question is, what happens to computer ethics? And my view there is that because, for me, the field is driven by the computer, right? The computer is the unique technology that's creating the problems, that you're going to have that focus, that simple theme, carry out in the future. So from now to the next century, we'll have a lot of problems in computer ethics. So I expect it to go on and on. I want to say one thing about a theory, because I wanted to get to that. As I said, I think Deborah's approach is kind of top-down. You started with the ethics, and you said, well, I've set the theories, and I'm going to apply them. Mine's always been kind of from the bottom up, or at least kind of, well, maybe both. I see that the problems coming up, but what I think happens often is that you don't just put the problems into fixed boxes. You kind of figure out how it goes. And sometimes what happens at the bottom, the new problems that arise begin to change your categories. So even though you think this is a problem of privacy, after you get a lot of problems of privacy of this kind, the notion of privacy itself begins to shift. And the concept of privacy we have now, and the concept of privacy we had 50 years ago, and the concept 50 years before that, are not the same, it isn't the same concept in a sense, right? There's a different paradigm case. So there's a way, a sense of, for me, in which the problems at the bottom begin to affect the categories. And if we think radically in the future, we think, well, what sort of beings could be in the future? For me, it's the instrumentation model no longer works, because the beings could be computers, right? So it's no longer clear, it's just an instrument. That other creature may claim more rights and so on. So that would begin to challenge our theory about what sort of creatures we could allow in the moral scheme of things. So I think I'll stop there and pass on.
What I want to say is, to start, even though we're talking about computer ethics as a rather new field, it actually has some history. The history goes back to the Second World War, and it started with Norbert Wiener. Started with Norbert Wiener back in the Second World War, who, in developing cybernetics, saw the social and ethical implications of computers and the ability of computers to replace human thinking and to do all sorts of jobs that humans used to be able to do. And Wiener was one of these remarkable people with foresight, and he actually laid a foundation for computer ethics back in the 40s and early 50s that is as good as any that's been laid, and is something that I'm encouraging us all to go back to and explore and make use of. It's absolutely remarkable what he was able to do with just the idea of a computer and how it might affect the world. Unfortunately, Wiener's foundation for computer ethics was not followed up by anybody until this ground floor development of computers took place that Jim was talking about before. And then various people, Don Parker, for example, in the 60s, got interested in computer crime and also proposed to the Association for Computing Machinery that there be a code of ethics for computer professionals, and actually put that first code of ethics together. And in the early 70s, Joe Weizenbaum from MIT developed his ELISA program and was absolutely shocked and dumbfounded to see the effect of this upon people, and began to worry about the ethics of developing computer programs of that sort, and wrote a book that became a classic in computer ethics. And then in the mid-70s, Walter Maynard developed the first computer ethics course at the university level and began going around the country giving workshops and lectures advocating that computer ethics be a separate branch of applied ethics. And he developed a starter kit, which he first disseminated himself and then got help disseminating the publishing company. And he kind of prepared the groundwork, training and informing hundreds of philosophers and computer scientists around the country about computer ethics. And then in 1985, well, first in 1979, Jim Moore got publishing and published his article on whether there are decisions computers should never make. But in 1985, you have a kind of watershed year, because then Jim's paper, What is Computer Ethics?, plus Deborah Johnson's book, the first major textbook in computer ethics, provided a kind of catalyst that brought this field together as an organized field. And since 1985, there's been an explosion of work in computer ethics that includes not only textbooks and conferences, but research centers and degrees. They're now at De Montfort University in England. You can get a PhD in computer ethics or a master's in computer ethics. So the field has just exploded since 1985, and Deborah's watershed book and Jim's watershed article, I think, were the catalyst that brought the field together as a research field. Typical topics we've heard of, privacy and ownership of intellectual property, security, distributive justice, professional responsibility, and so on. These are kind of typical topics in computer ethics. And I won't say more about that. There'll be papers here, and you've already heard some things on that. What I do want to talk about a little bit are what you might call meta-philosophical questions about computer ethics. Because part of the problem that we've all faced in trying to decide what computer ethics is, and also in trying to answer questions like the one whether computer ethics is unique or not, and whether it will disappear or not, it seems to me part of the problem is that we're mixing meta-philosophical questions with philosophical questions. And if we can get those distinctions clear, I think the questions will clarify and our answers will be better. Philip Bray recently suggested that there be two kinds of computer ethics activities. One he calls the mainstream approach, and Maynard and Johnson from the 70s and 80s, early 80s, seem to, in Bray's mind, kind of epitomize that, where you use utilitarian, Kantian, and Aristotelian analysis on cases that are generated by computers or computer technology. That's, as I understand it, what Bray means by the mainstream approach. That's a bit different, of course, from Jim Moore's policy vacuum approach, as I call it, and Jim and others have explained that quite well here, so I won't go into that here. But there is an alternative on that which arose recently. I did some work with a colleague in England, Switzerland, and we tried to take Jim Moore's suggestion that computer ethics involves policy vacuums and see if we could take an actual case to see what policies were involved, whether there really were vacuums, and so on. And what we ended up doing was discovering that when you say we need to revise policies and ethically justify those policies, the policies turn out to be an incredible complex of already existing laws and assumptions and practices and habits and cultural arrangements, etc., etc. The cluster of policies that count as policies, if you take Jim Moore's definition seriously, turn out to be an incredible, complex, overlapping, crisscrossing set of policies that run through the entire culture, that start with the individual and the family, and go right through to international treaties and agreements and policies of the United Nations, it's quite complicated. So it's interesting to follow up on Jim Moore's suggestion that you see computer ethics as identifying policy vacuums and then clarifying muddles and finally recommending new policies. As I see it, and I'll soon end with that point, as I see it, what really happens when people do computer ethics is they don't go back to Kant and Bentham and Aristotle and other ethical theories like the philosophers want them to do, or like the philosophers have said they do. They rather go to the received policies of the community in which they live, and they try to accommodate these new problems to the cluster of received policies that the community lives with. And that's what really goes on among computer professionals and politicians and the everyday people. And we need to make sense of that from the philosopher's point of view. And so what we do is we take the tools of philosophy, like Bentham and Mill and Kant and Aristotle and so on, and we try to make sense of that cluster of phenomena and that cluster of policies. I think we get confused if we talk about ordinary computer ethics, and we also think either of dealing with this cluster of received policies on the one hand, and then using the tools of the philosophers to make sense of them and to clarify them and justify them. The other approach in how to do computer ethics that Bray suggested, he calls values disclosure, where you look at the impact of computer technology on the things that humans value. Well, what about this future of computer ethics? Will computer ethics disappear or not? We've already heard that the different perspectives, except for one from my colleague, Christine Gorniak, and I've called this the Gorniak hypothesis because, as far as I know, no one else has come up with this view. But now let's make the clear distinction between ethical theory on the one hand and then this cluster of received policies and working with computers on a day-to-day level on the other hand. According to the Gorniak hypothesis, the ethical theories that we currently have in the West, Kantianism, utilitarianism, and so on, these developed as a response to the printing press revolution and the Enlightenment. And they really are 18th century parochial theories that developed in Europe in a certain historical era. And it is now the 21st century, and she suspects that with new developments in the world, as revolutionary as the Enlightenment was, new ethical theories will replace those old parochial ethical theories. And so her view is that there's currently going on in the world a global conversation. And this global conversation is discovering, in Jim Moore's language, policy vacuums about the use of information technology and how people, to use Deborah's language, how people interact with each other and treat each other and so on. This global conversation will reveal globally visible policy vacuums that need to be filled. And when you fill these policy vacuums, you're going to have to fill those policy vacuums in a way that satisfies not just the West, but people in Asia, people in Africa, people in the Pacific Islands, people all over the globe. And so if you succeed in coming up with a set of policies to fill the global policy vacuums, you will have a truly global ethics. The parochial ethical theories from the past will be replaced by that global conversation by the philosophers dealing with this new global phenomenon of the global ethics that is emerging from the global conversation. Instead of the parochial ethics of Kant and Bentham and Buddha and Confucius and you name your philosophical hero, all of those parochial localized ethical theories will be replaced by a global ethics. And computer ethics becomes just ethics. Okay, that's the Gorniak hypothesis. Of course, we know the Johnson hypothesis, and she's explained it much better than I can here, so the traditional ethical theories will remain essentially unchanged. And here's the distinction that I think needs to be made. If we talk about toaster ethics, okay, here's the point. The reason why computer ethics is more than toaster ethics. Computer technology is changing the very concepts upon which ethics was built by the Western philosophers. What is it to be rational? What is it to be conscious? What is it to think? What is it to know? All of these fundamental concepts upon which all of Western philosophy are built are being changed by computers. And when you change the fundamental concepts on which philosophy, including ethics, is built, then you need a new philosophy and a new ethics. And so if you make that distinction, I think Deborah is right, that the traditional theories from the past, if you assume that these fundamental concepts are not being changed by computers, then they'll remain the same. And once they remain the same, information technology and information technology gets absorbed into the community and becomes part of the furniture of the earth, then computer ethics as a separate field disappears because the computers are now built into the rugs and the ceilings and the cars and your pockets, and we don't have computers to focus on anymore. But I think the argument really is a meta-philosophical argument. The debate about whether computer ethics is unique or not is the question, are computers changing the fundamental concepts of philosophy, including the fundamental concepts on which ethics is built? If the answer to that is yes, then the old, to use Gordiak's language, parochial 18th century theories of the West, or the theories of Confucius and Buddha and Lao Tzu and others from the East, will have to be replaced too.